I'm so delighted to have you back again. So not only did the afternoon scare you away, the afternoon shift, but also, you know, I told you only had a couple weeks with me, and then you can go on to somebody else. So we are on to just a classic of CBI. I mean, he hardly needs any introduction, but I appreciate, again, you come in. This is the fourth now of six total in-depth sessions. Our presenter today, again, is a classic. He's one of the big catalysts. When I was a student here back in the day, he was my advisor. And I really look back and see him being used by the Lord to kind of steer me in the direction of pre-seminary studies when I started out of secondary ed math. And not only was he a good advisor,
good
but he
idea.
Was, yeah, what an idea, and here I am. So a former professor of mine, now the current chairman of the department, and again, just a regular at CBI, a favorite, and so we're delighted to have him again to talk about the Gospel of Mark, certainly something he knows very well. So please join me in welcoming Dr. Daniel Pavlov.
I know, I feel like a classic. Well, you know, I'd like to see that code for old. And get it older. And if I was any inspiration to Brian in terms of going into the parish or the ministry, it was, well, look at it, Pablo can do it. Oh my gosh, anybody can do it. I know I could do this. So there we go. He's a wonderful, wonderful leader for us. And also, Tina has been so good for our whole department, for CBI, of course, but also for our whole department. We're just so thrilled to have her with us, and we know it's exciting events are coming in their family, but we're very glad to stretch this out as long as possible with her being here. As you came in this afternoon, you got one of the handouts. I took it, and if not, you do need this. This is what we're going to follow along, and it's pretty much all here. So if you like to take notes, you'll be disappointed because it's pretty much all here. We do have answers that we're going to be looking at. And you can already run over to the Gospel of Mark, and that's where we're going to be starting. And we'll stay in the Gospel of Mark today, as you know from the title. I'll start with a prayer, and then the show and tell will begin immediately after our prayer. So let's pray. Heavenly Father, thank you. We have a day like this. Well, thank you that we have a roof over our head on a day like this. And you give us safe travel to all be here today. Thank you that we have this 2.5 hours to center around the message of Mark, but really to center around your unending stories. You did marvelous things, miracles and daring acts that you knew would bring about, in the end, your ministry, your death on the cross, and your resurrection. Help us to see, as Mark unfolds those events, how they dramatically draw together, and help us to see ourselves in those stories, too. All this we pray in Jesus' name. Amen. Well, if you'd start with me on the top is, I really do love those commercials. You know, the one where the product is the miracle knife, the waterproof tape, and when you think they're done, they have the classic sentence, wait, wait, there's more. Don't you love that?
Yeah.
I love those commercials. Now, I'll go off the script a little bit, because not because of the miracle knife or the magic tape, and I've just got illustrations of miracle knives. These are not miracle knives or magic tape. But anyway, just illustration. It's not because of the claims they make, you know, oh, I can make a boat bottom out of the tape or something like that. But it's the, what's the more? Because you know there's going to be more, right? 1995 for merely the knife or the roll of tape. Oh, no. Plus shipping and handling, of course. What's the fun? It's guessing what's the more, isn't it? That's the fun. So if this is the miracle knife, what's the more?
Two of them.
Exactly. But will they be the same size? Or are they going to give you a, you know, do you get the mini miracle knife? Or the serrated edge miracle knife? Or how about the holder for the miracle knife, right? If you get the magic miracle tape, what's the more? What do you think? Oh, you have become connoisseurs of these ads. Okay, you get the miracle tape. Now, of course, obviously my duct tape's been used here a little bit, but
another color, maybe.
You could get another color. That would work. Okay. And so maybe in a different thickness, you know, or width, I should say.
Oh.
But there's also, remember, the miracle tape guy is the miracle caulk guy. And so then you can get the miracle caulk to go along with the miracle tape. Never know. That would work too. That's the fun. I just enjoy those commercials when I don't know them yet because I'm waiting. All right, what's the deal? You know, because there's always got to be something more. Well, that's where we are. We're in the third paragraph now. Mark follows this pattern. Now, I'm sure that Mark is in heaven right now saying, look, I'm not some television huckster telling you questionable stuff for 1995. No, of course he's not that. But what he is there's more. And he'll start stories for us, and then when you think we're coming to the conclusion, in other words, the sale, he says, wait, off he goes. There's more. And the more is going to be a second story. And the fun of that is it's going to be like or oh so different from the one we started with. In other words, like my illustration. It's going to be another miracle knife. And we're going to have a story in which one and the other are very close together. And you'll say, oh, that makes sense. You know, I got the miracle knife, and then I got the little smaller miracle knife. Or I got the serrated edge miracle knife. Okay? You're going to have that. You're also going to have, though, with Mark, a story where, a la my tape story, you're going to get the miracle tape, swing the pendulum, you're going to get the miracle caulk. Oh, the difference. You know, one's on a roll, one's on a tube. Oh, my gosh. That's going to be also part of Mark. But there's still going to be something that ties them together. So that's what we're going to see. Now, we're only going to do three of these stories today in the time that we have. That works out just fine. There are several. And commentators in the Gospel of Mark argue about this. Well, they don't argue about this. Everybody agrees Mark does this. He starts a story many times, doesn't complete it, begins another story, completes that, and then, well, you could either go back there or I'll just keep going on in progression. He returns to the first story and finishes it. How many times does he do that? Pick a number. The commentators will choose anything from 5-6 times. Everybody agrees. The three that I chose for us are absolutely on everybody's list. I've seen it in the low to mid-teens. And when you're at that point, you're kind of stretching, I think. So we're not going to go to that far extreme, but you'll certainly see that many times. Our three-part study takes on three of these stories. Commentators debate. We'll take the three without any question. We're going to start with healing miracles. Those are going to be the two miracle knives. They're very close together. And almost in a lead-up, one leads to the next. Very natural. That's going to be our first one. Then we're going to a strange miracle with a sharp message. Oh, absolutely. This is going to be one of the most interesting ones. I'm going to go to the second miracle. And that's going to be more like my tape-to-talk idea. And the last one is just lovely. It's a contrast of greed and generosity. All right, so first of all, let's go back to the commercials, if I may, just for a moment. What commercials do you remember that make that pitch? Wait, there's more, and what's the more that usually comes? I use the miracle knife, the miracle caulk. What else have you seen sold under the banner of, wait, there's more?
Pans.
Oh, yes. Yes, the copper something or other pans, right? Isn't there a copper or
something? That's the miracle nonstick, blah, blah.
And what's the more on the miracle pan that just slides the what should be burnt on? Do you get a little pan? You get the big pan, the little pan? Is that what they sell?
Utensils, maybe.
Oh, maybe the utensils?
Right.
But isn't the idea on that one that you can't scratch this stuff, you know? Right. I mean, I'm not saying, sorry, you go after it with a knife, but what else do you remember? No, wait, there's more.
Oh, beauty products are great for that.
Yeah. Oh, are they?
Oh, yes.
So
you may not pay attention to those.
No, I don't. I borrowed them. We're going to use this later. There's a place for this. So if you get the lotion, what's the more of the lotion? You get another?
It's a different, usually a different type. But it's along the same line, but maybe you're buying the anti-wrinkle cream and now they're going to give you a moisturizer with it or something.
There you go. Okay. I said that like I knew what the difference was between those. I don't really, but anyway, sounds good. One lady one time asked me, she looked at my arms and she said, now what product do you use to keep your skin like that? And I looked at her like, well, whatever soap Holly has in the shower, I don't know. You know, she kept asking me about the product. And then one lady finally said, he has no idea what you're talking about. And I really didn't. And I don't think my arms are anything special anyway. Is there another that sold? Wait, there's more. I like this. The pans, the beauty products. Oh, go.
Well, they don't always tell you this in the commercial, but when you call to order things, sometimes they have a deluxe version for a little bit.
Do they? Yeah. I didn't know that. So what's the deluxe? Like,
might be a little wider.
Oh,
somehow it's better.
I could get the longer knife, maybe. Now, the deluxe costs a little more, I'm guessing?
Yes. They throw it in. They say, oh, if you accept this call, then we'll throw in a free knife. Which knife would you like?
Fantastic. I didn't think of that one.
I did it once, and they said, oh, but for $2 more, you can...
And by the way, do they now have your cell phone number and will call you without working? But is that anything new? Who isn't getting just every call from every place in the world? Da da da. If it's not our kids, forget it. I'm not answering. So we know this basic idea. You think you're done, or the sale is made, about to be made. No. Let's step aside and take on something new. Well, let's do that with the first one. As I said, the first one is two healing miracles, chapter 5. Mark chapter 5, head on over if we do it. You'll never have to read. We'll never go down the row or anything like that. But, you know, if you'd like to read, that would be wonderful. We'd be glad of you doing that and such. And what we want to do is set the stage now for the beginning. And in that case, it's Mark 5. Oh, by the way, we should look a little bit at the context that just precedes this. And it is awfully dramatic. If you're looking, for instance, on chapter 4, 35, and 41, Jesus has just calmed the storm. This is the first of those storm miracles where Jesus is in the boat with the disciples. Of course, he's asleep there in the midst of the storm, battling away. They ask him, don't you care? We're about to die. And he rebukes the storm. Instantly, it's calm. And then, look, they ask with great fear, who is this? Now, if you would take that last verse of chapter 4, I think that's a wonderful theme to carry into the next chapter. You know, if the disciples themselves, having seen this miracle, are asking, who is this? Aren't you waiting for an answer? Because Mark doesn't instantly leap up and tell you. Oh, Mark did. Chapter 1, verse 1, he says, the beginning of the gospel of Jesus Christ, the Son of God. So from verse 1, we've had the answer. But he's not going to just simply tell us that just like that. So take that last question of chapter 4 and let it run with you in this next chapter. Now, is there somebody who's got the answer? Look at the start of chapter 5. If who is this is ringing in your head, look who comes screaming out of the tombs. Chapter 5, this man who comes next. Look at verse 3. There was a man with an unclean spirit. He lived among the tombs. No one could bind him, not even with a chain. He had often been bound with shackles and chains. He wrenched the chains apart. He broke the shackles in pieces. No one had the strength to subdue him. Night and day among the tombs and on the mountains, he was always crying out, cutting himself with stones. And when he saw Jesus from afar, he ran and fell down and, crying with a loud voice, said, what have you to do with me, Jesus, Son of the Most High God? Is that the guy you expected to answer the question?
No.
I mean, isn't this a wonderful answer? I know who you are, the Son of the Most High God. That's good. But who did you expect would answer that, who is this question? A demoniac racing unclothed from the tombs with broken chains dangling at his wrists? I'm not thinking that guy. Who would you expect would answer the question? I know who Jesus is. Maybe... Yes, one of the disciples. Wouldn't this be time for Q. Peter to step up and do it? Well, we get quite a change, don't we? From the, I think, expected disciple, right? Or maybe someone who had been healed by Jesus. Now, this man will be healed. But before any of that happens, the shrieking from the one possessed by the demons answers our question. Now, is there going to be more to that question? Maybe that answer, you bet. That's the rest of our chapter, chapter 5. All right, so now let's start the first of the ABA, or the first part of the first story. Chapter 5, would somebody read verses 21 to, it was right through to 24. Or 21 to 24, that'll get us started.
Oh, it begins, Jesus heals a woman in Jairus' daughter. And when Jesus had crossed the canyon in the boat to the other side, a great crowd gathered about him, and he was beside the sea. Then came one of the rulers of the synagogue, Jairus by name, and seeing him, he fell at his feet and implored him earnestly, saying, my little daughter is at the point of death. Come and lay your hands on her so that she may be made well and live. And he went with him.
Isn't that a marvelous thing? He implored him. That's a nice way to say it. He parakaleo, the paraclete. if you maybe remember that in John, the Holy Spirit is called that's the Greek word, the paraclete, the comforter, the one who speaks alongside, the one who speaks alongside and to us and from God. Same verb here, but here maybe it was a little more of a taking you by the arm and moving you with the words. So, my first question on the bottom. Oh, I hear we're on the bottom page one. The commercials we've been discussing last only 30, 60 seconds. No time to waste. Maybe that's why they speak so fast. Don't they talk fast when they say, oh, because their success is just rolling. We can imagine Jairus had the same sort of urgency and understand his insistence. Jesus comes with him. How do you see Jairus as he explains to Jesus what needs to be done? How do you think he speaks? How does he walk? How does he take Jesus along? How do you picture Jairus?
Well, a certain amount of desperation, I picture him.
Absolutely. I mean, my little daughter is at the point of death. At least that fast, don't you think? Was he yawning?
Don't start.
Why? Oh, yeah, I know. I should never yawn because it's absolutely contagious to anybody in my class, that's for sure. So I prop him up with coffee. But speaks fast. Now he's on his feet, and then Jesus begins to go in that direction. How do you picture Jairus with Jesus as they're going in the direction of his home? We'll just make going that way as his home. How do you picture the two of them?
Hurry.
As much as he could.
Right.
You know? Do you see Jesus running? No. But Jairus almost wouldn't want to.
Right. And the fact that he also, he falls down on his knees, he is like almost pleading.
Yes. Yes.
Because he knows who this is. No question in his mind that it's the Christ.
Well, and think of how you just answered the question that ends chapter 4. Who is this? Mm-hmm. Now we had the demoniac announce, I know who you are. Have we swung the pendulum here a bit? We went from the demoniac to who is Jairus? Synagogue ruler. Isn't that an interesting swing? Now the demoniac has the answer. He doesn't yet have the miracle, but he has the answer. Jairus, seeking the miracle, yet I think acts in a way that leads to the answer. He doesn't address him. I know you're the Son of God. I know you can do this. But please, simply please, come. And he hurries him along. Why is Jairus thinking that he needs to bring him to the little girl? And this makes sense. I don't think we would question Jairus like, what are you thinking? But in order for his daughter to be well, what has to happen?
Miracle, man.
A miracle, exactly. Isn't just going to be, let's go home and see how she's doing. No.
He must have known she was beyond that point, maybe.
Absolutely. And so Jesus has to come there quickly. What do you think it took to be Jairus? That is, leave his daughter's bedside and go away at this time. Oh, my gosh. Yeah, exactly. I mean, can you imagine how he had to explain that to, we don't know her name, Mrs. Jairus? Can we just call her that? Is that all right? How do you explain it to Mrs. Jairus? I got to go, honey. I'm leaving at a point at a time like this. Their daughter is desperately ill. I'm leaving. Well, not a whole, I'm leaving, I can't handle this. How do you think he explained to her, I'm going to go?
But if he came out of a synagogue, maybe he had gone to pray. I don't think he knew that Jesus was there.
Well, I think that we might suggest he had perhaps heard of Jesus, had some kind of knowledge that he is the miracle worker, right. Has healed others. We certainly know that he's healed others. Already by Mark chapter 1, there's the broad healing of everyone who came to him, he healed. So we've already got a broad healing. Jairus isn't recorded as being there, but maybe he's heard. After all, synagogue is a great place to hear things, kind of like the narthex of church. Where do you go when you want to hear stuff? I was 12 years in Butternut. I was a little 400-person town. I tell you what, the narthex of St. Paul's is the place to be. Well, Immaculate Conception Catholic Church, they had a narthex too. If you could have been in both, you would have totally, you would have known everything in our little town. Well, at least everything I'm willing to tell you. Bertha often wanted me to tell more than, well, she knew, and all that I knew. Bertha, are you picturing a Bertha with me? This is a real name, by the way. And Bertha would say, Pastor, what do you know about, Agnes? Right. So, well, really not much. I know But I'm not going to tell Bertha, are you crazy? You know, and I, poor Bertha, I think, often had the feeling of, why do we even have him around? I mean, he doesn't know anything. It's useless to keep this guy around. All right, so perhaps he had heard overheard some aspects of the miraculous healing that this man had done. And so, come and help. But what a dramatic thing to leave at that time, to leave your child.
Did he know that Jesus was going to be here? I mean, it says that seeing him, he fell at his feet. Or did he just go out and there's Jesus and was the spur of the moment thing?
That's a wonderful question. We don't know. We don't know. Now, when we get to the second story, I'm here my first story. When we get to the second story, I think the woman is going to have a very focused, centered approach. Did Jairus know? I'm going to say that he had heard of Jesus' nearness. And I was looking kind of the middle group right here. Otherwise, why would you? What's going to pry you away from your daughter's bedside when she's this ill? Oh my gosh, I cannot imagine leaving at that point. Unless you can say to Mrs. Jairus, I've heard of him. They say he can do miracles. I'll go get him. And by the way, what do you think Mrs. Jairus said?
Go now.
Go! And hurry. Right? Don't dawdle. So bring him in. So I think that's some of the drama of Jairus, and he has Jesus coming along. I don't know to what degree you tugged on somebody's elbow, or as we would do, what did you do in the first century to hurry somebody along? None of us know the social customs on that. So can you just have him sort of tugging and holding his elbow and come on, we got to go. All right, well, let's turn the page here. If you're following along with our questions, I'll go to page 2. Page 2. The key for Jairus is that he needs Jesus to get to his daughter and to do so in time. That's a double header. Time is short and distance is great. You feel the vice that our friend Jairus is in? I've got a long way to go and a short time to get there, as an old movie line said. If he needs to be there and soon, how does this seem reasonable when you consider the illness and the way that it could be cured? Here's our dilemma. We're a long ways away in a very short time. But that makes sense if you're Jairus. And we've got to conquer this distance. And we've got to beat the time. Why? Just think, it's a reasonable expectation. It's going to be contradicted later by what Jesus can do.
Right.
But up until this time, what do you need? Yeah.
In his mind, I guess some of the premise I have trouble with here, but as you've talked, but he needs the distance to be covered so that Jesus can lay his hand on her, prior precedence to heal her.
Exactly.
He's not, I don't know that he has faith in Jesus at this point.
Perhaps not, or at least, and certainly not in a distant healer. If this healer is going to do anything, he's going to have to, be there.
Yeah. His background as a synagogue ruler would, in my mind, put him at desperate for his daughter.
Oh, yeah.
And
oh,
he, regardless of which side he's on about Jesus, he has heard through reliable sources that this works.
Right.
So if he's got faith, it's any faith that it's happened before,
right,
and if I can bridge that distance quick enough, it can happen for me as well.
I can get there.
And that's all I see in this. I don't see that he has faith in Christ at this point.
And maybe he isn't yet the one to answer our question of,
right,
who is this?
Right.
Right. The demon shouted it out, and when we get to our, I'm going to put our second story right over there, I think she has a greater, maybe, understanding, faith. But Jairus, I've got to get the healer. That's what they say he is.
Right.
I've got to get him here. And no, doctors do that. I mean, you can go to WebMD all you want, get some advice, and that might work. But don't you kind of want to actually go to the doc if something is actually wrong with you? No offense to WebMD and various places on the Internet to get distance advice. But I would just assume, if I'm really worried about why my knee hurts, have, you know, the doc look at it himself and say, okay, here it is. So there he is. Yeah.
I'm listening to what you said.
Oh, don't do that.
You'd be wrong. Well, how many more healers would there have been? Oh, he's already done quite a few, you know, supernatural things in this area.
Yeah.
They all knew about it, and so did Jairus, and his group at the synagogue was already up in arms and maybe a little irritated by this time. All right. Wouldn't you now know that this at least is somebody more than we've ever seen before?
Right. And if we may, I'm going back up to the context, even further, chapter 3, Jesus has healed in a synagogue, not necessarily, of course, the one that this man works at, but he healed in a synagogue the man with the withered hand.
Right.
Completely restored the man, but the problem was, what day was it when Sabbath day?
Okay.
So, and they didn't contradict the healing. There was a given that, yes, this man's hand is fine. You know, sometimes it suggested arthritis, and we've all seen someone afflicted with that, and the hand is not withered, isn't dried up, but just locked into place. Da-da-da. Now, he's fine, but he did it on the Sabbath. So the miracle is a granted. But the time, place, that's wrong. So how did he do it? That's going to rage. And then says, by the way, in chapter 3, verse 6, the Herodians took counsel that they might destroy him. Already in Mark chapter 3, verse 6, the cross's long shadow is already there, which is earlier than any other gospel. Think about this. In Matthew chapter 3, we don't even have the Sermon on the Mount yet. That doesn't come until chapter 5.
Wow.
In 3, verse 6 in Mark, we've got to kill him. Isn't that amazing? That long shadow is what's overlaying virtually all of Mark until the end.
And Jairus would have known that.
Well, perhaps.
Oh,
it's not the same.
Not
it's not the same synagogue. But if there was a
an narthex.
Right. All they needed was worthless. God bless her. Oh, it was great. Right. If they had synagogue.org, you know, they would have been posting and blogging like there's no tomorrow. Who knows if they did? But if they did, they would have loved it. Da, da, da. So we've got this. Now, the nearness of Jesus to solve the problem, okay, that's a wonderful thing. Think about the two episodes we had just before this. The nearness of Jesus, does that solve the problem? The disciples are in the boat. They feel they're going to drown. And where is Jesus relative to them? In the boat with them. And so is the mere nearness of Jesus enough to save or solve the problem? Not at first. They feel they've got to just come. Can you be Jesus for us just for a second? They feel they really need to wake him up. I mean, just having him here, that's not going to do it. We need him awake and doing something. Now, our friend Jairus has that need for the nearness, the presence of Jesus to solve and to heal his daughter. Do we find that with our friend the demoniac? Well, he certainly seeks the nearness of Jesus, doesn't he? He comes charging out after him and comes straight to him. In his mind, again, that nearness makes perfect sense. Let's keep on going and see what nearness can do. Oh, yeah, sure.
Is it safe to assume that the demon-possessed man was a pagan?
Well, that's a good question.
Because, I mean,
he was into
the herd of pigs.
Right, and he's in the area of the Gadarenes and such, on the Sea of Galilee.
So they wouldn't have been.
It may well be that he was not one of the people of Israel. We don't know. It doesn't say. But I would think that'd be reasonable given the area in which this miracle happened.
So I think it's interesting that the miracle of healing extended beyond just the Jews.
Exactly. Oh, it absolutely does. In chapter 7, we have the Syrophoenician woman whose daughter is going to be healed at a distance. That works really well. He wants to go with Jesus, and he wants to get in the boat and go with and continue with Jesus. Jesus says, no, go and say what's happened. But that might still have been possible even if he was a Gentile, you know, to come with this entourage of the Jews who are surrounding Jesus. But after what this man's been through, I don't think social customs are going to be a barrier to him after what he's experienced. He's lived in the tombs. He can travel with the disciples if he wished, I think. That's a good question. Well, let's do my next little paragraph here. We might have the same feelings and actions as Jairus. We need a nearness of Jesus to the problem, and we need to get his full attention. Others have problems too, but right now we need to be the center of God's attention. Why have you felt that way? And why is it, and I'm all for this, why is it a natural need? I need to be the center of your attention, Jesus. It's just, I'm not trying to make Jairus a selfish man, just a very very human man, that my problem is really, really, really important. And you need to be centered, focused with me on that problem. Yeah, Dave, can I? Dave.
Sorry.
No, let me just shoot this. There it is. Oh, yeah. When have you felt that, like?
It's a crisis.
Absolutely.
I mean, it's almost immediate.
Exactly. And not that you're a selfish person, but it's just that other people's problems, how would you like to vision God listening to your prayer when you're in that crisis, similar, for instance, to Jairus?
Well, you want his rapt attention.
Oh, is that a nice way to put it? His rapt attention. God better be making great eye contact. I don't want to be scary here. But, but I mean, wouldn't it be just that total, I am focused. Here, I'm going to get rid of the watch. There is no watch between us. You know, as long as this takes, I'm here with you. Doesn't that make perfect sense? And I think when we pray, we'd love to have that thought that God is listening solely to me. Isn't this one of the great mysteries of life? He says, I am. And I'm listening to every other soul and every other act that is happening, and I watch every sparrow lest it fall. But trust me, I'm listening to you. We can't do that. You know, we can't multitask that well, can we? No, we can't. Da, 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 da. Oh, for, yeah, exactly. No, exactly. I don't know what that pat on the shoulder meant, but let me just tell you my miracle experience. Can I tell you? If I'm talking to Holly on the phone, where's my cell phone? Where is my cell phone? Oh, it's somewhere. Well, you can tell I'm not a 20-year-old, because if I was a 20-year-old, by God, I know where my cell phone is. Exactly. Where is it? You know, I think I put it in my motorcycle pack. Well, yeah, there it is. But I'm on the phone to Holly, and I touch the keyboard to do email while I'm talking to her. Does she hear that? Mm-hmm. It makes no noise, but she hears it. She can hear one little, well, I can hear that you're busy. I'll let you go. How? Tina, how? Because you said, but yeah. The woman has bad spot. I think there's one of those nanny cams in my office, and it's straight linked right to her. She got the whole thing. Tina will explain the whole reference there in a second. But anyway, yeah, and she knows if I move out of the zone, you know. So anyway, but we can't multitask that way. We cannot pay that kind of attention. Isn't that a marvelous thought? But God does. Jairus, I'm focused. I'm here. I'm listening to you. And to everyone else, I don't know quite how we can reconcile that in our minds. Because we do want the exclusive, total attention of God. Let's face it. At least I do. I'll be the selfish one who wants God totally focused on me right now. And he says, I am. And everyone else in the world. That takes faith, doesn't it? To trust, yes. I'm not just take a number, get in line, then we go. Well, that's our friend Jairus. He is hurrying things along. Jesus, you've got to come. You've got to come. You've got to come. That's all good. We understand. Let's go to the woman. Here's our next one. And there was a woman. Oh, could somebody take us? How about if we just run? If you'd be so kind, run 25 to 34, the whole happy news. 25 to 34.
And a great crowd followed him and thronged about him. And there was a woman who had a flow of blood for 12 years and who had suffered much under many physicians and had spent all that she had and was no better, but rather grew worse. She had heard the reports about Jesus and came up behind him in the crowd and touched his garment. For she said, if I touch even his garments, I shall be made well. And immediately the hemorrhage ceased, and she felt in her body that she was healed of her disease. And Jesus, perceiving in himself that power had gone forth from him, immediately turned about in the crowd and said, who touched my garments? And his disciples said to him, you see the crowd pressing around you, and yet you say, who touched me? And he looked around to see who had done it. But the woman, knowing what had been done to her, came in fear and trembling and fell down before him and told him the whole truth. And he said to her, daughter, your faith has made you well. Go in peace and be healed of your disease.
What a wonderful story. All right, so this is our be. This is the next story. Because as much as we're rushing forward with Jairus, we want to know what's going to happen. We've got to get there in time. Stop. Put Jairus on hold there with your remote. And step over. Let's tell the story of this woman. My opening question here, the woman with the bleeding suddenly comes into view. She must have come from behind, touch him in a brief, shy way, slipping away. How is she the opposite of Jairus in so many ways? Oh boy, there's many of these. How is she the opposite of Jairus in so many ways? There's a bunch of them.
Well, she doesn't verbally approach him. Right? She just kind of sneaks in and...
Exactly. There's going to be a falling at his feet, a la our friend Jairus, but they're completely at the opposite ends, aren't they? Jairus is going to come first. Many words in front of Jesus, which I always find interesting. He falls in front of Jesus, this very man who's now going to redirect and hurry Jesus as fast as he can. You know? So he bars his way and then moves him. She's not certainly coming at him. You know, and anyway, hey, I need to touch you. No. Keep on going.
I think her faith, which is brought out in the story, is a telling factor that she knows that if she simply touches, she'll be healed.
Our friend Jairus, and we made this point, it seems reasonable for him to say, I need to get Jesus to the problem. I need to bring him there. And I need him to know that and to agree with that. This woman knows, if I just touch him, that's all. I can just touch the hem of his coat. In fact, I don't need to hold his hand, anything like that. How else? If you had this type of bleeding, were you ritually clean or unclean? It's kind of an unclean. Unclean, exactly. Should you be in a crowd so packed together that they're all jostling with one another? No, not really. So tell me about this woman compared to our synagogue ruler, who probably has a little bit of personal space in almost any crowd, and yet a proper place in that crowd. Isn't this woman marvelous? Yeah.
Well, she either had courage or she was very desperate.
Very desperate. Very desperate. Oh, did you notice the line there in Mark, da-da-da, she spent all that she had, da-da-da, and it only grew worse, da-da-da. Yeah. Here, look at verse. She had suffered from many. Isn't that interesting? But only grew all the worse. Spent everything she had. Oh, by the way, Luke, the physician, doesn't have that verse.
Really?
Yeah. Isn't that interesting? I wonder why Luke left that one out. A little bit of humanity in the gospel, isn't it? You know? I wondered if Luke and Mark said, you know, really, you didn't need to put that part in. You know? They were trying. If you read some of the commentaries, the supposed cures, horrible, just awful. Not only did they take all your money, but it did no good. And this woman suffered much. So I'm done. There's no more money. You know, there's no more cures. I expect that in 12 years, that's a long time to try every sin you can imagine. Can you imagine the grapevine of suggestions that she got? Oh, one after another after another. Can you imagine going to sleep in hope? Maybe this is the one. And waking up how? No. Maybe? No. I can't imagine 12 years of this kind of disappointment. Relentless disappointment. 12 years. Now, she has faith. Given that darkness of disappointment, how does her candle of faith look to you? When she says, all I got to do is touch him, I'll be well.
It was almost gone out, but then she had that glimmer of hope because she had heard what Jesus had done.
I really think that image of a tiny candle, which by itself is not significant, unless everything is turned off, all the world is dark, then it really stands out, doesn't it?
Yeah.
What a woman. To, in that context, to say, all I have to do is touch it. Isn't that remarkable? Now, as far as we know, there's no biblical record of a similar illness, so I don't think it's that we can say, well, her cousin had the same problem and he fixed it last week. You know, and again, we don't know specifics, but there certainly is no biblical record by which she could say, and see, it was done, and there's no hint of it. She doesn't say, as he did for Henrietta or Mabel or Bertha, you know, he'll do for me. And that would have been fine faith. It would have been wonderful. But she doesn't have that, it appears. She doesn't have that. Merely as an assurance, if I touch his cloak, I'll be well. Isn't that wonderful? Does she have any idea that she's going to have to pay for this? No. Isn't that wonderful, too? That this man, so how is he different from the docs? The doctors that she's been seeing. They took everything she's got. Think about this one. The men who took everything from her did her no good. The man who heals her will ask for
nothing.
Isn't that an interesting contrast? And she believes it. Now, if you were her friend, can you imagine saying, yeah, that makes perfect sense. Men who do you no good take all that you have. The one who heals you will want nothing. Isn't that a remarkable faith? I mean, can you imagine being her best friend and saying, sure, go for it. No. Yeah, you're right.
I do have a question. The statement, your faith has made you well.
Right.
That statement bothers me.
Mm-hmm.
Because I understand her trust, and I understand the significance of that. But it's Jesus who made her well.
Oh, yes, right.
So why does Jesus say to her, your faith has made you well? To me, it's Jesus that made her
absolutely.
Well.
Absolutely. You know, I don't know why, and I'm sure others will have a better explanation. Baptism, the catechism on baptism comes to my mind. How can water do such great things? Do you remember the answer from the small catechism? It's not the water indeed which does them, but the word of God which is in and with the water. And remember the last time? And faith which trusts us word of God in the water. And so, is it her? When baptism saves us, as Peter says, baptism now saves you. And you say, well, how? Is it faith? No. It's the word of God in the water, which promises baptism now saves, or forgiveness of sins through our baptism, and faith, which accepts that gift of God, which is itself first in the water. And so is there healing power in Jesus? Absolutely. What connected her to that healing power of Jesus?
Faith connected her.
That's it. Faith would be that connective reception. But is it the power itself? No. So could you change that sentence to include, and rightly so, the power or Jesus himself?
You certainly could.
And it would echo then what we say about baptism, that it isn't faith that saves us via the water. It isn't enough to say water and faith, but it's the word of God that makes these great promises. And then faith is the reception of it. That would work.
Yes.
You betcha. And also, though, think about where this faith is going to lead to in the next story, as Jairus really needs faith because of the news that's going to come to him in just a minute. Oh, it's going to hit him very, very much. Absolutely. Let's see. Anything else on our friend, the woman and Jairus? Oh, yeah.
I just thought this was an interesting tidbit in here. Because this woman obviously would have been declared unclean, she was forbidden to touch Jesus.
Right, exactly.
So, I don't know, I guess I just never knew that. I didn't realize that. And I wonder if that played into her just touching his garment then, too.
Well, that, too. That would have been enough to make him ritually unclean. Not a problem as far as Jesus. And I can go back here to our talking about in chapter 3 and elsewhere, where has Jesus already performed his miracles? That is, in the synagogue, on the Sabbath. He's already crossed the line as to our normal protections of what makes us holy or clean in the sight of God, and it's not going to be merely the avoidance of evil. Think about that. How can he come and save us if he never touches the evil that we are? It would be hard to be one of us and never be tempted and never to know ourselves. Remember what Paul said of him. God made him who knew no sin to become sin on our behalf. That's pretty powerful, isn't it? Not just to, you know, touch sin, but to become sin on our behalf, that we might become the righteousness of God in him. So if he won't become sin, neither can we then, in God's view, be the righteousness of God that he gives us. Now, that's pure gift. It's not like, oh, I finally made it, you know, but rather that exchange. Luther calls it the great exchange, you know, between the one and the other. Yeah, oh, very good. Well, we're going to have more on her and her different. Oh, how is her expectation of Jesus both different and similar to Jairus? In one thing, they're both certain. She's very certain that he's going to heal. Here's an interesting contrast. When does she expect the healing to happen?
Now.
Right now. And I think you're absolutely right. That when she says, if I but touch him, I will be well. And she doesn't say, right now.
Sleep my head.
Right, exactly, right, you know, or, you know,
exactly,
and don't you guarantee that some of those quack cures were not promising immediate results? But, I mean, if you're going to be a quack, don't promise immediate healing. What do you promise?
Come back,
wait, there's more, remember our theme, money, you know, oh, it's not quite working, you need another treatment. There's no way on earth these quacks weren't stretching this all out. Absolutely. If they know anything about quackery, I mean, they must. You don't get all the money at first. You stretch people out, set it up, until it's finally done. All right. So, but she expects this healing right away. All right. As soon as she touched Jesus, she knew she was healed. I'm reading now from the middle of page 2. Jesus knew it too. If he had asked her, I expect she would have wanted to slip away unnoticed. Right? Is that fair? I just presumed on that. That when she touched him and knew, I'm healed. David, you're kind of being Jesus there. I'm just slipping away. Tell me, that would have been her exit plan. I'll touch him.
Mm-hmm. Please.
The crowd goes on. And do you think she celebrated at the moment that she touched him?
No.
Did a little, you know, touchdown dance or anything like that? No. Again, very low key, very incognito. Very, very different. And so slips away. That would have been her plan. But Jesus stops all and asks, who touched me? Obviously many did. Because, of course, the disciple says, how can you ask that? Everyone is touching you. Everyone is crowded around. Obviously many did, given the amazed answer of the disciples. But Jesus stays rooted. How did he ask the question, who touched me? I often ask my students, long-suffering people they are, how do you think this was said? How do you think this was read? You know, and this is a wonderful, true account. So we don't even have to imagine, you know. Well, we have to imagine, of course, to answer the question. But Jesus really did stop and say, who touched me? How do you think he said that?
Oh, I would guess it was in kind of one of those rhetorical frame of mind things. I mean, he obviously knew.
Oh, he knew. Right.
But,
right.
You know, it's
right.
Like, okay, you know, to bring it to the forefront, to bring it...
Yeah.
So people could see him.
Who touched me? Did he? See, think about the danger. On the one hand, he knows. Is this like the parent who leans back, looks at the broken lamp, and then says, because by the way, you only have one child, who broke the lamp? See, I got that down. Oh, I got three children, you know. And there's always one pretty much culprit, you know, our son. Oh, my gosh. You could just put off 90% of the time, you could put it on Steve. And says, it wasn't that, though. It wasn't the, who touched me?
Right.
No. Who touched me? Now, is there a puzzlement on his brow, on his, you know, I don't know if first century people nodded their brow like we do, but let's just presume it's common to people. Is there a puzzlement on his brow? Who touched me? No, and that's what the disciples are somewhat arguing against. Why are you asking that? I mean, look at, everybody is touching you. You can't ask that. Is it harsh? Who touched me?
No.
I need some personal space here, people. No, that isn't that either. Oh, for the woman, how do you think she heard it? She, her plan again, and David, again, I'm already giving you some space, because we don't know how far she got. But let's just presume it's about like this by the time he asked. And she's slipping away. How do you think she could have heard that? Who touched me? Guilt. Oh no. Found out. Spotlight. You know. On you. There. Da da da. Oh. So my question then, the next one is, why? It's done. she's healed. He knows she's healed. He knows that she knows that he did it. Call it good. So why did he stop and say, who touched me? And I know I'm not saying it as well as he said, you know, but just allow that. Why did he stop? And don't forget, Jairus is in full forward mode, right? So stopping is not on Jairus' plan here at all. So why did he say, who touched me?
Jesus is a teacher.
Oh, see, this is a wonderful one. We got three wonderful answers ready to go. This is a teaching moment, isn't it? Finally, 12 years of frustration has come to an end. Let's make something of this moment for her and maybe our friend Jairus. Keep on going. Why did we stop?
And maybe she was known by the crowd, and he wanted her to know that. He wanted to give her confidence in knowing that she was healed
right.
from her disease. And it ostracized her.
Exactly.
And so he wanted, because in the story he says, go in peace.
Right.
So you know that she was anxious and...
Exactly.
About even coming.
Right. And maybe somebody in the crowd even was thinking, what are you doing here? You shouldn't be here. You haven't been healed, have you? You know, da-da-da. So she needs that peace and maybe that public affirmation from the teacher himself saying, she is well, da-da-da, and such. Also, do you think that in 12 years, oh my gosh, after all these treatments, has she had little moments of wellness? A little, at least to her own mind, thinking, I think I'm better. Oh, I imagine so. But what's the great fear come tomorrow morning? They'll all be back. How does he want her to sleep tonight?
At peace.
Think of this. For the first time in 12 years, you go to sleep. And you sleep in peace. And for the first time in 12 years, you wake up in the morning and know, I am well. Isn't that an amazing thing? What's 12 times 365? A lot. I have no idea. I'm no math major. But finally, what a gift. After 12 years of those fitful, fearful nights and mornings, you go to sleep in peace. You will wake up well. What a gift to give her. So don't worry. Wow, what a gift. Doesn't that transform the who touched me from the, as you said,
could that who touched me be an invitation from Jesus to the woman to confess her faith?
Oh, it could have been. And maybe what, and I'm often wondered, afterwards, don't you think somebody in the crowd said, what's the deal? You wouldn't necessarily just know what's happened. Wouldn't that have been a wonderful time for her to say, let me tell you what he just did. Let me tell you how I am. You know? And so again, we don't know that. We're going to play a little bit with that as we go on. But presume let's allow her still to be in the crowd, following along perhaps, or at least some small circle is going to say, what did he say to you? What happened?
Yeah.
You know, if the crowd is of some sort and he's talking to Tina, you know, Dr. Gehrman and Tina are talking, well, I'm getting a little, you know, hard of hearing. It's all those motorcycle rides. I can't hear that well. Da, da, da. So I would want to go and find out. What? That sounds like the soundtrack to my life. What? You know? Kids are getting quieter. Because when we do prayer requests, I have to keep saying, okay. So he asks and waits for her to come forward. What reassurance did she need from his words to her? It is well. You are forgiven. You are well. Not forgiven. I mean, that's not in this text necessarily. And go. Isn't that a marvelous thought? Oh. So he says, who touched me? Your faith has made you well. Go in peace and be healed of your disease. Now, be healed, of course, it already happened. So why would he say, since it's already happened, be healed of your disease?
It's complete.
Public declaration.
Public declaration. You're clean. It's good. And it won't come back. Yeah, we're done with this now. Isn't that marvelous? I often wonder if she went and visited those docs. See, I'm a bad person. I would go back and gloat at him. Yeah, well, so it worked. No, it didn't. You know.
And you know what it cost?
Exactly. Exactly. Maybe put. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. Right. Exactly. Yeah. Right. Right. This guy. He's not part of the AMA of the first century. That's for sure. Or whatever. Yeah. Yeah. Maybe she walks a picket line in front. The guy's a quack. It doesn't work. Save your money. No. No. This reveals my low nature. We're good. We have to feel for Jairus. By the way, we're going to be done. We'll take our break at 4:10. We'll be done with this unit easily, and we might have started the show and tell of the next one. So we're right on the money. We're doing really well. Well, you got to feel for our friend Jairus. So let's go, Jairus, and verse 35. And while he's still speaking, would you run it 35 to 43?
While Jesus was still speaking, some men came from the house of Jairus, the synagogue ruler. "Your daughter is dead," they said. "Why bother the teacher anymore?" Ignoring what they said, Jesus told the synagogue leader, "Don't be afraid, just believe." He did not let anyone follow him except for Peter, James, and John, the brother of James. When they came to the home of the synagogue ruler, Jesus saw a commotion, with people crying and wailing loudly. He went in and said to them, "Why all this commotion and wailing? The child is not dead, but asleep." But they laughed at him. After he put them all out, he took the child's father and mother and the disciples who were with him and went in where the child was. He took her by the hand and said, "Talitha koum," which means, "Little girl, I say to you, get up." Immediately, the girl stood up and walked around. She was 12 years old. At this, they were completely astonished. He gave strict orders not to let anyone know about this and told them to give her something to eat.
Wow, what a marvelous thing. We have to feel for Jairus during this. The waiting for something more must have been terrible for him. So this, remember, we're in our wait something more mode with the woman. Well, that wait must have been killing. Wait. There is no wait. There is no time to wait. We're waiting to heal a woman who's had the same disease for 12 years. What could Jairus very reasonably say to her?
Maybe we could do this later.
Maybe we could do this later. 12 years in a day wouldn't kill you. 12 years in a little moment. Just wait. Isn't that one of the most amazing things? And Jesus says of the woman who's had the bleeding, not fatal, for 12 years, I have to deal with her first, though your daughter is dying. I don't think you and I would have bet on that one or seen that one coming. But he did. Well, it's too late. Too late. Too late. He wants to get Jesus as soon as possible, but now it's too late. The messengers say, "Your daughter is dead." Too late. And why are you even troubling the teacher anymore? Pretty heartless fellows, I think. Dave, you're a very nice man. I don't think you would deliver the news of a death quite like that. Your daughter's dead. Why are you bothering the teacher? Wow.
It would be hard to find the words, but those would not be
there. Those would not be there. You're teaching a counseling class. Well, you might struggle with the words. Those, no. You know, there's not even a "I'm sorry" in there. But Jesus tells him not to lose heart. And here's the fun. This is the connection between our middle story and the end of this first story. What might the woman have said to Jairus at this moment of despair? Or why would her experience be valuable to Jairus? Even if she doesn't say anything. But let's allow if she did. Let's just imagine this. Or at least having seen what he's just seen. And surely he's paid attention because, I mean, she's stopping them from getting there. Either what might she have said or might her experience have said to Jairus when Jesus says, "Don't be afraid, don't despair, just believe, go." What could you imagine her saying or her experience saying to him?
See. See what has happened.
See what's happened to me. For me, just a talk.
I am not.
Thank you, Jesus. Yeah. It just took a touch. Right. Yes, but my daughter's dead. just the bleeding. What might she say? It's not the difference between her and the little girl. What's common? Not their differences. The one in whom you believe in. But he's the same. He's the same whether he's to be touched for the healing of his 12-year-old malady or the resurrection of the 12-year-old girl. He's just the same. Just believe. I've often wondered, do you think she went along with, or did she stop, turn, and leave? And we don't know, do we? And no, we just don't know. My native curiosity would have been, I'm going to go with. Also, the freedom of being inside a crowd and nobody can say anything about it. You know, I think I would have loved to have been in a crowd. I'm right here. Did you notice that? I touched you. Go ahead. Da, da, da. Yeah, she can finally be there with that crowd. And what a story to tell. Trust it. Well, off they go, of course. And such. Jesus comes to the home and he dismisses the mourners, though they mock him. He takes only the parents and the circle of disciples, holds the little girl's hand, and tells her to get up. Isn't that a marvelous line? When he says to her, you know, the little girl. And he says, little girl, I say, arise, or get up. Right? I'd like you to picture, how did your mother tell you when it was past time to get up, to get up? Right? Fairly abrupt, wasn't it? You know, da-da-da. Did you get your name in there? Maybe. Da da da.
And it says middle name too.
Middle name too. There. Yeah, that's good, Dave. That's good. Was it David? David? The whole thing. I was always just Danny, but it was just Danny. Get up. And boy, my mother could say that in just a, you know, sharp da da da. And it's right now. Was there any with your parents? Just please go with me on this one. Was there any? Oh, but I'm tired. Are you kidding me? It's 5 a.m. We got to milk those cows every single day. I grew up on a dairy farm. Are the cows going to wait because I'm a little tired? Are you kidding? No, it's 5. We're up. We're milking those cows. Get up. What a wonderful way for him to say to her, get up. Now, I don't know how exactly, but certainly with authority and yet compassion. Get up. With full expectation, not, let's see if this works. Oh, no, none of that. No. Get up. That's why I like the image of your mother. Because when my mother said at 5 a.m., Danny, get up.
Now.
There was getting up. There was getting up. Right now, we're milking. Let's go. And doesn't he say that to the one who's dead? Now, what a great picture when, at the end of time, he stands over all our graves. And he says to that which is perhaps reduced to dust. What is he going to say in essence to each of us?
Rise.
Get up. And we will. Isn't that a marvelous thought? Not a many, 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 many times. Not in a hopeful way. Let's see if this works. But with that same certainty. Get up. Arise. And we do. What a wonderful thought. Well, why make this resurrection so simple, so hidden? Why not let the whole town in on it? Isn't this an interesting difference? The healing of the woman is in the setting of the crowd. And the whole crowd can hear, your faith has saved you. Well, if we're going to bring in a whole crowd for that miracle, what do you expect is going to be the audience for this miracle? Raising the dead. You're getting, my expectation is even bigger. Let's put this really on the stage. But no. Just the parents and that immediate circle of disciples. Well, wait, remember that we're going to still have to build up the miracles to the crisis point of we really have to kill him. I mean, we really have to kill him. We've seen that already in chapter 3. But we need some time yet to walk with the disciples before we press the enemies of Jesus against the wall where they say, now, we have to kill him now. That'll come. So many have suggested that that's part of the reason for this secrecy, this don't tell anyone. Keep it down. There we go. Well, down to the bottom number 2 apply. Let's just do that one. Yeah, that's good. I wonder if the woman who was healed ever met the little girl. We don't know. What might they have said? What might the woman have said to the little girl, both the recipients of the miracle that day, the miracle that day? What do you think they might have said? The little girl's 12. She certainly can speak and hold forth. And what do you think?
Rejoice in the Lord Jesus.
You certainly could. Every day is a treasure. Every day is a gift. You were brought back from the dead. I was as good as dead. My life was nothing. He gave us both our lives. Mm-hmm. Isn't that a wonder? Just a thought. He gave us both our lives again that day. One was 12, and the other one had suffered every day for that same number. And he gave them back. And what did it take? A touch and a word. Little girl, get up. What a great picture. So there's our ABA. Now, that one was the miracle knife and the miracle knife. Another is healing and healing. Very, very similar, close to each other, all that good. Would you turn the page with me? We'll just go on to the next one. And I can, let's see, what else is this? I'm on page four. Do it again. All right. Let me just get this one started, and then, like I said, we'll take our break for 10 minutes. Do it again. You can't do just one. I think I've shared with you in the past times we've been together. We have two grandchildren now. I brought pictures just of our first granddaughter, Gabriella. Shameless advertising. By the way, now that I know my phone is over there, videos without cost will be shown during the break. You know how cute these kids are. But no, this is one cute grandchild. Da da da. And if you've been a grandparent, da da da, you know you can't do just one. You can't just do one trick. So toss her, lift her, do something, you know, hopefully unique, and catch her on the way down. It's great. And what is she going to say?
Do it again,
Grandpa. Do it again. Well, pride kicks in. You think, I can do this again. Sure, why not? So toss, spin, da-da, catch, da-da-da, down she comes. Absolutely. Grandpa is now getting tired. Grandpa is not sure he's going to catch her the third time. Grandpa says, I think I hear Grandma. And this is a great line. I think Grandma's calling. I didn't hear it. No, Grandma has special earrings. You know, I'm attuned. Yeah, you know, like I'm attuned to Grandma. She wishes. But anyway, as such, I miss more than I hear sometimes. But anyway, do it again. Do it again. That's where I want us to be. Do it again. How many miracles can he do? Well, now we've gone from chapter 5, which was right in the center of the miracle. The miracle started chapter 1, you know. 5, where we just were, 3 great miracles there. The demoniac, Jairus' daughter, the woman with the bleeding. How many more do you want? Well, they do continue. 5, 6, 7, oh, big. 8, 9, we cast out another demon out of the demon-possessed boy. Now we're going to get down to, look at chapter 11. How many more do you want? Well, we're in Jerusalem in the final week. How many more miracles do you need? During the week from Palm Sunday up to Thursday evening, we might expect miracles to come with his teaching. There'll be one more. One more. But what do you expect? So what might have been the one last miracle Jesus did in the presence of many during that last week? What's the one last one? Put your money down. If he's going to have a now, in this context of Jerusalem, the last week, Palm Sunday's already happened, Monday, Thursday's still to come. Between Monday, Thursday, Palm Sunday, what do you think he could do? What would make sense? Herod's there, Pilate's in town. What do you do? Oh, by the way, and where do you do it? Just think, what might make sense? Be his. We're very politically attuned these days. This is a nonpartisan idea. You're his campaign manager, okay? And you want to get the maximum of the setting and the time and his ability. What would you suggest he do? By the way, you only get one. One miracle for that week. What do you think?
Raising from the dead is pretty good.
Raising the dead is pretty good. And we have 3 already. 3 is a good number. Right? We raised the little girl. We have the son of the widow of Nain, remember, being carried out. And then we have Lazarus. Lazarus in Bethany, just miles away. But, you know, that was a bit ago. Now we're in that week. We can do a 4th. And where, Dave, let's go with this. Where should we raise the dead? To get maximum effect. In Jerusalem, exactly. Near maybe the
temple
would be good. Herod's court, Pilate's court, something like that. Maximum exposure. Right? Timing would be important before the 6 o'clock news. We make the feeding and did all of that. This would all be great. Is that what he does? It is as opposite of that as we could imagine, and that's the fun. One miracle yet to go. One seen by many, out in the open. But it's not the raising of the dead. In fact, it goes the other way. And with that, Bingo. 10-minute break. Come on back at 4:20. We're in great shape. Thank you so much, and we'll be right there, ready to go on that miracle. Well, we have an hour to do now these two stories. We got it started, though, and we're in great shape with how that's going. So we're over in chapter 11, and I asked you on this page 4, of course, what might have been the last miracle that Jesus had done, would do in the presence of many before, that week where he dies. What should their reaction be? We didn't stress also the who would you want to have see this last miracle. Again, if you're going to have a final public miracle seen by at least several, not just an individual, then who? Well, I think maybe a large crowd, maybe dazzled enemies. We know that later Herod is going to ask to see a miracle, and perhaps we would preempt that and give him such a one that he would never be able to deny or explain away. That could all be it. Well, here it is. We'll study the surprisingly simple miracle Jesus does do. It's the outer half of one of Mark's two-part stories. Again, power of miracle, not only in the work itself, but in the meaning it gives to the story that Jesus has. So Mark 11. Let's run on over and get it started. Mark chapter 11. And we're there in the midst. Excuse me. We're in the midst of this triumphant end. If you look at chapter 11, you see that now we've had Jesus coming in, Hosanna, we've got the Palm Sunday excitement, all the beginning there. Would somebody read for us verses 12 to 12 and 14, 12 to 14, just those three verses.
The next day, as they were leaving Bethany, Jesus was hungry. Seeing in the distance a fig tree in leaf, he went to find out if it had any fruit. When he reached it, he found nothing but leaves, because it was not the season for figs. Then he said to the tree, "May no one ever eat fruit from you again." And his disciples heard him say it.
There we go. Well, I asked you on page 4, is the cursing of the fig tree the miracle you expected? I'm expecting the answer is no. Isn't this something? If it is, you are amazing, of course. Concerning the more frequent miracles of healing diseases, saving disciples from stormy sea, raising the dead, feeding thousands, all benevolent miracles. Right? No one ever harmed. Did you see this one coming? That this last miracle is the death of the tree. Again, what a change of direction in expectation as what they do. So how is this cursing of the fig tree different and unexpected? Well, first of all, the miracle is not to a person, but merely a tree. It's just a tree. Think about the list that I had earlier. It's people, 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 and people again, either directly affected, the lame walk, lepers cleansed, or certainly directly helped. The storm is calm, and the disciples are saved. The 5,000 are fed and go away full. But now it's just a tree, and the tree is dead. After cursing the fig tree, what did you expect to happen to the tree? If you were going to write this out, can you be, and don't take this the wrong way, but can you again be the script writer, the campaign manager for Jesus, saying, all right, all right, all right, if that's what it's going to be, we're going to curse the fig tree, what would you have done to the tree?
That it withered and died.
Right, and how quickly?
Quick, like that.
Just like that. And maybe you remember we did a whole thing on this some years ago, that Mark's favorite adverb is the adverb immediately. And he uses it 41 times in the Gospel of Mark. Wouldn't this be a great time just to play that card? I mean, again, look at that verse. And he said to it, "May no one ever eat fruit from you again." And the disciples heard it. And the tree immediately with, I know it doesn't say with, yeah. Right? Just as you're standing there, right. Holy cow! you know, like when you walk out to your house and you say, "Holy mackerel, what happened to that tree?" Our neighbors are cutting down a tree. Holly and I aren't that observant. They're right across the street from us, and they're cutting down this tree. And now that we look at it, it's dead as a doornail. And we're standing there. We were standing there on Sunday going for a walk before church. Is that what did that? Obviously, it's been dead for quite some time. My gosh, it's the end of the growing season, and they're taking it down, as they should. Well, this one is full of leaves, isn't it? So what should happen, just in your mind, when Jesus said, no one will ever eat fruit from you again. Absolutely. Like they seem to in your neighbor's tree when the wind is blowing your way. Right? Don't they? Our neighbor's beautiful maple tree, which we love because it shades our car, which sits outside. But man, oh man, only when there's a west wind blowing, then the whole thing comes down, doesn't it? Because we're on the east side of the tree. All right. What apparently, though, did happen to the tree after Jesus speaks? You got the answer in you're looking at. What do you see after verse 14? That's it, nothing. Exactly. It appears, and we're going to see that from Peter's reaction coming, that nothing immediately happened to the tree. And so it's full of leaves. It gives the promise of fruit, but there is no fruit. And so he says, no one will ever eat fruit from you again. Disciples heard that, and they kept walking. Now that is an interesting beginning. So tell me, what do you want to know about the tree? The future of the tree. Right. Yeah, what's going to happen? What's going to happen to the tree? What's going to happen to the tree? This is a classic, again, where the story is begun, and we are on the edge. What's going to happen to the tree? Which suddenly matters to us. And it didn't matter diddly to us. Did it before this? We were saying, what miracles should Jesus do? Raise the dead, heal the sick, dazzle the crowd. The tree was not on our plan there. But now, we want to know about the tree. And he says, let me tell you another story. Wait, there's more. And we're going to the more now. So let's go to the more.
What about the disciples?
Yes.
They would be wondering, here's the teacher.
Right.
Always has parables, always has a message.
Right.
Generally, they finish. They understand. And now they're walking along and probably quiet. What's he going to do? Lightning?
Right. We're looking exactly.
Yeah. So there's suspense.
If I were one of them, and I don't know, I'm just going to say, if I were one of the disciples, and there's can I just make you the body of the disciples? I'd be the guy in the back.
Yes, that's exactly what I was thinking.
What did I think? Come on, I'll catch up with you. Awesome. Right? That would be me. And of course, we don't know, we just presume, but human nature being what it is, wouldn't you just sort of want to, why? Drag your feet a little bit and say, now? Yeah,
sure. Well, even Elijah brought down fire from the sky. You would at least expect that.
At least. Wouldn't that be something? And so if you want to fricassee something, right, and that was certainly a show of power, right in the face of Ahab, Jezebel by report, that would have done it. Right.
The fact that he opens the story with, and Jesus was hungry.
Yeah.
You would have thought maybe he would have produced some food.
Wouldn't that have been wonderful? So he comes up to this tree with a promise of food, hungry as he is. There is no food. You're the Almighty and have all ability to do any miracle. And he could have said, let there be
figs.
Figs! And what would suddenly have happened to the tree?
And figs.
Poof! I mean, and that got to be really good. I mean, really, primo figs. I thought that would be a good fig from a bad fig, but
it's almost like a setup job because Jesus was hungry. Then they see a fig tree, and you know, rational, logical reasoning tells me figs.
Figs.
I'm going to make figs.
Exactly.
Because I'm hungry.
It's like my mentality.
Why?
I'm hungry. And the next thing I ask, honey, do you need anything from the grocery store? Well, I go, you know, and don't worry, I'll pick up a whatever, a few things extra. Yeah. She likes sending me on the motorcycle because there's only so much room in the saddle for extra stuff, you know, da da da. Well, there was a sale on the pie, you know, da da da. The pie, by the way, doesn't fit well in the vertical of the saddle. So I say, yeah.
It says it wasn't the season for figs.
Isn't that a fun one?
Why would you expect to find figs on a fig tree when it isn't the right season?
The commentators kill themselves over this one. They really, really do. And I think that one explanation study Bible notes will give you, that is, that while strictly speaking it wasn't that season, the presence of the leaves gave hint for an early crop, perhaps off this tree. And I'll just hold up for every apple orchard at this time of year. Are all the apples ready now?
No.
Not all. Not yet. Not ready. Are there trees that look ready, though, as you're driving by? Yes. Absolutely. And so maybe the Honey Crisps aren't ready, but you can get a, oh, I don't know,
Macintosh
or something early. What was it?
Red
Delicious. Is that the one? What did we all grow up with that they gave away, that they gave us to at school? They were kind of mealy and tough as could be, and they made you swear off apples. Was that it? Red Delicious, that was it. We grew them on the farm, too. I didn't think there was a good apple, because we grew them on the farm, and there's no way we're buying apples. We have our own trees, and it's just not. And then you discover there's something like a Honeycrisp. You think, my gosh, this is great. Why didn't we raise? Well, of course, they weren't around when I was a kid on the farm. That's why we didn't raise them. Well, let's go on. And they came to Jerusalem. All right. So would somebody give us 15 to 19? 15 to 19.
And they came to Jerusalem, and he entered the temple and began to drive out those who sold and those who bought in the temple. And he overturned the tables of the money changers and the seats of those who sold pigeons. And he would not allow anyone to carry anything through the temple. And he taught and said to them, "Is it not written, my house shall be called a house of prayer for all the nations? You have made it a den of robbers." And the chief priests and the scribes heard it and sought a way to destroy him. For they feared him, because all the multitude was astonished at his teaching. And when evening came, they went out of the city.
Oh, isn't that marvelous? Well, at first glance, it doesn't seem to make much sense, not much connection. We have the single treatment of the tree, and now we go to the temple.
How?
But physically, there's an enormous difference. A single tree, and now the whole temple. But what's the tie? My first question on top of page 5. How is the temple much like the tree? What is the lush life of the temple seen by everyone? It's like the tree how?
Mm-hmm.
I talked about, remember, the tree is lush and full with leaves. Well, what's the lush life of the temple?
People.
There's people there.
Animals.
And bantering, and exactly. Animals. Chink, 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 money changers. Yeah, there's life going on, it seems, doesn't it? Just as the tree was lush with its leaves, the temple seems to be lush with the liveliness of its commerce going on. But no fruit. And there's the parallel. What's the fruit that's missing? It's more than one. So now we go from single figs to... But what's the fruit that he's looking for that's missing among all the lushness
prayer.
Of the temple? Dave, let's go with this one. Here's a great one. When Solomon dedicated the first temple, and we know this is the second temple, but when Solomon dedicated the first temple, remember? And he had that long list that, of course, this temple cannot contain you. You know, God is beyond anything we make. But when your people come to this place, and when they pray, hear them and forgive. Remember that wonderful line that boils down the life of the people in this temple? What is this place for? It's not to compete with God. It's not to replace God. But it's for us to come to so that God will forgive. Isn't that a marvelous thing? Not reward or praise us, but forgive us. But that's not happening here. That's not the center of the life that's going on. What is the fruit? And this is just beginning. What is the fruit that Jesus could legitimately be looking for? That among all the lushness of the leaves, you might say, it's missing.
The word is being taught.
Yes.
Enjoy.
Right. You know, and we don't know. But I imagine that the information most crucial is, what's a sheep going for today? What's the exchange rate on a drachma? What's the, That they got. And you hear, and I'll bet you any money there's a competition going on. So-and-so selling it for this. You tell me people haven't changed enough that there isn't a good guy on the other side undercutting you for this, and then for this, and then for this, and back and forth. And, oh, the furor. Is anybody reading, how about Isaiah 40? Comfort, comfort ye my people. Speak tenderly to Jerusalem. Tell her warfare is over. Her sins are paid for. Is anybody saying that amidst the din of the selling and the money and the animals? No. It's hard to imagine.
Right.
It's hard to imagine. There's money. Now, we've got a wonderful image coming about a wonderful woman in the temple. Now, she's the opposite, and it's not where we're going here. There's money in this temple, and the rich are giving their donations away. Is that the fruit he's looking for? Hold up. But there's another one who gives, and remember that image?
Everything.
She gives everything she has, and two little copper pennies. Right? That's the fruit she's looking for. It's awfully small. Awfully small as far as fruit is seen. Yeah. Those two little copper pennies. I bet they just got lost in the avalanche that the rich might have given. But she gave everything she had. Shoulders all their stuff aside, doesn't it? Yeah. So there's the teaching. There's prayer. There's seeking forgiveness. There's true generosity. Those would all be the real fruit that he could say, that's what I'm looking for. You have the lush life of the many leaves, just like the tree. But when I came looking, there was nothing. There was nothing. So why would, I'm on the third question here on page 5, why would it be natural that Jesus would expect to find desired fruit there in the temple and among the people of Israel? We might especially remember this is the end of his ministry, so the people of Israel have had 3 years to develop this fruit. Why might he reasonably come to the temple and say, it's harvest time, you know, it's time for fruit?
He might expect the opposite and want to make a clear picture.
Oh, there certainly can be. And he knows, of course, all of this. He knows the nature of people. That wonderful line from John chapter 2. Remember the ending of John chapter 2, and I don't have the voice to do this as well as it should be done. But in the old translation, King James, I believe, put it in this way. He needed no one to instruct him, for he knew what lies in the hearts of men. Isn't that marvelous? You don't have to tell him what people are like. He knows what lies in the hearts of men. Isn't that marvelous? And so, unsurprised. But has he encountered the temple before? Is there reason to come to this place and expect fruit by now? And if I could put that by now. Yeah, already at age 12. The first of the actions beyond the birth account is his, and of course his presentation at the temple, but his teaching at the temple. That's some time ago. Has he been here before to cleanse the temple? John chapter 2. The second of his actions in John chapter 2. First, he fills the wedding with the joy of the water turned into wine. And immediately after he changes water into wine, where does he go? Jerusalem. Where? To the temple. To do what? To cleanse the temple. And so the cleansing of the temple are the brackets of the beginning and ending of his ministry. There's the two separate events. The beginning, John chapter 2, and now in the synoptics, the ending, the cleansing of the temple. Have I told you to clean? And now he comes again. Now, your children probably never had messy rooms. And Tina, never. This will never happen. Ever. No. But holy moly. I could take any one of them. But anyway, when you have a child who does not get the message, clean your room, right? Do you remind them, say give them a reasonable time to get it done, you know, an afternoon or a day or the weekend? Do you remind them that I told you, clean your room? Well, yes, I hope somebody says, you know. I mean, unless they said, was I supposed to do that? How could I make it clearer to you? You're supposed to clean your room. And so has he told them, clean my Father's house? He did that at the start of the ministry. How's it turned out?
Same old.
The junk came back or new junk came in. Right. I mean, your kid will go either way. They hide it under the bed and then just drag it out again, or they find new junk. Right, exactly. Yeah, push it in the closet, and then finally they open the door and it pours out. Da-da-da. Oh, by the way, I will give you hope. Well, you're already there. Da-da-da. Our daughter, the youngest one, was not the neatest person in terms of her room. Can I just put it that way? You can imagine. She got married a year ago, and I seriously was wondering, how in the world is this going to turn out? You know, when she does that, Mom and Dad are not on her case, you know, are not going to say, you are cleaning your house, aren't you, honey? Don't say that. So we went there for Christmas. They got married in September. We went there on Christmas. They live in Denver. Oh, my gosh. take your shoes off, Mom and Dad. We don't wear our shoes in the house. As soon as we walked in, I said, you're kidding me. Whose child are you? You don't say that. It's like, it was amazing. It was so neat. It was so clean. It was just wonderful. We went there this summer, same thing, and just beautiful. And the slightest thing just bothers her because it's not right. And, oh, my gosh. And it's so there's hope. It's a wonderful thing. You know, if you're still living in hope, it's a good thing. And hats off to you, Nicole. You have a very, very clean house. And to her credit, her husband, Dan. Yes, she married a guy named Dan, just like her dad. Her husband, Dan, is very neat. I suspect Dan has some effect on the how clean are we going to keep this place. So it's good. All right. So we have every expectation for fruit, good fruit, in the temple. There's no question about that. It ought to be by now, and it hasn't. But now that the temple is cleansed, it's time to return to the fig tree and complete the first story. So, let's go. After the drama of that, would somebody give us 25? That'll take it, that whole paragraph. 20 to 25.
The lesson from the withered fig tree. As they passed by in the morning, they saw the fig tree withered away to its roots. And Peter remembered and said to him, Rabbi, look, the fig tree that you cursed has withered. And Jesus answered them, have faith in God. Truly I say to you, whoever says to this mountain, be taken up and thrown into the sea, and does not doubt in his heart, but believes that what he says will come to pass, it will be done for him. Therefore, I tell you, whatever you ask in prayer, believe that you have received it, and it will be yours. And whenever you stand praying, forgive if you have anything against anyone, so that your Father also, who is in heaven, may forgive you your trespasses.
Isn't that marvelous? Well, let's dive in. Do you think the disciples were eager to see the tree? Did they even remember the curse?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Oh, see, now, we had a wonderful difference here. Going on. Let's go, and I can go either way. No, I'm with you, sir. I'm with you. You know, given what they just saw at the temple, is the fig tree the top of their list of I wonders?
I took it that Peter said he remembered, and it was kind of like, yeah, it was out of my mind, and then he saw the tree, and oh, yeah.
Hey, look at that. Hey. Yeah, no. Yeah, no. If you go in the context of, wow, did you see what he did to the temple? Wow, did you see how the priests took that? Not well. You know, wow, I wonder what he's going to do next. You know, today, what are we going to see? I think in that way, the tree is probably not on the top of their list compared to what we just saw in the temple. On the other hand, you could say, of course they're excited, they're interested because
it is unresolved. And they haven't made the connection between the fig tree, right, and the temple yet. And Jesus is going to make sure they do.
Exactly. And so, carefully taking them right past that dot where it's unmistakable, there it is, there's a tree. I'm sure they didn't have to see it from, you know, one of those trees way over on the far side of the football field. No. It was right along as, excuse me, as they go along. There's the tree. Oh, my gosh. Do they even remember the curse? Perhaps, perhaps not. Jesus takes the disciples to see the tree in order to make a lesson for both tree and the temple's cleansing. But first, the surprise. How do you think Peter said, verse 21, where he said, Rabbi, look, the fig tree you cursed has withered? How do you think he said that? Not like I just said it. I guarantee you that. I tried to be like the GPS lady on your dash. You know, turn left in 400 feet. 200 feet. Now, for gosh sakes, that would be how I did it. But now, how do you think Peter said it? Rabbi, look.
There are two exclamation points.
Exactly. You know, and I would agree completely with the editors who put that in. You know, the Greek text, of course, doesn't have exclamation points. They don't have punctuation. But I'm with the ESV, if you're looking at ESV, I'm looking at ESV. How could you not have an exclamation point? Right. Rabbi, look! Now, how do you find that ironic? And such a testimony to the kindness and patience of Jesus. that he lets Peter have this moment of, look! Yeah.
They have witnessed time and time again Jesus saying something and a miracle happens.
Exactly.
Why wouldn't his word come true?
Exactly. I can say to the young man being carried out from the city of Nain, young man, get up. And he does. I can say to the little girl, get up. I can say to Lazarus, Lazarus, come forth. And the dead man came forth. They're just the three resurrections. If he with just a word can do that, if you can do the greater,
the tree had no
what do you
chance.
Expect? The tree had no chance. Exactly. And I know Roundup is having a difficulty. It's like we just dunked it in Roundup, and it's got, here's over. I'm not trying to get into the lawsuit business there, but just that image, if you would. Exactly. The tree has no chance. Really, we're going from the greater to the lesser. If he can do these things, calm the storm, cast out demons by the legion, da 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 da, and he says, this tree is dead. Given a chance, I can kill a tree. Don't you have a neighbor who seems to have that talent with every tree in his place? Da da da. And just.
And my house.
Oh, and your house too, exactly. The ones that are right on the property line, so you both get the deadness. You know, that's always good. So we could kill a tree. He did. But isn't it merciful? Isn't it kind of Jesus to let Peter have this moment of discovery and almost a look! That tree that you cursed, it's withered, it's dead. Isn't that marvelous? And Jesus could have been so scornful, couldn't he? Said, of course it is.
Yeah.
He could have just dismissed it. Don't even start. I know. Why don't you? Couldn't he? What patience. And just simple kindness.
Yeah.
And again, if I can go back to the reason I started with Gabriella, our granddaughter, isn't this somewhat like a parent with a child? Where your child or your grandchild is so excited about something. To them, it's the biggest thing ever, the most amazing thing ever. And how are you when they're excited and they tell you their excitement? Do you just go, yeah,
every day.
Every day. No, how are you? Oh, this is great. Mm-hmm. You know, they say, Grandpa, Grandma, you know what? What, Gabriel? Mm-hmm. And then what? You know, I don't know, you know. Daddy moved the seat up on her strider. She's thrilled that her seat got moved up because it means she's a big girl now. She's two. You know, but do you know strider? It's a little, it's like Fred Flintstone. You paddle it. And a bike that you paddle like Fred Flintstone is fantastic. It's great for a two-year-old because they can only go as fast as they can paddle, which is a good thing. Downhill, it's a little sketch because there's no brakes. Fred Flintstone. But, you know, on a level ground, fantastic. So, by the way, this is a true story. She was all excited last time we FaceTimed with her because Dad moved her strider saddle up, and now I'm a big girl because my strider saddle came up about an inch. Da, da, da. Are you excited for her? Oh, absolutely. Are you saying, you're not big? No, you're excited. And so with Jesus, I think with Peter. Not that he's excited, and of course Jesus didn't say, really? Well, look at that. It actually worked, didn't it? No, he knows. But what kindness on his part. So surprising for our friend Peter. Well, let's keep on going. The point of cursing the fig trees was to provide a backdrop and warning for the cleansing of the temple. The temple was to bear fruit, but it had become an empty tree. If someone discounted the cleansing, then let the cursed tree be a warning. What's the serious warning that comes from the tree? If you had eyes to see, what would you learn? You temple people.
Well, bear good fruit or die.
Exactly. And aren't you seeing here what we started a little bit going back up the gospel story with John the Baptist? You brood of vipers, who warned you to flee from the wrath to come? Every tree that does not bear good fruit is cut down and thrown into the fire. Very first, Mark chapter 1. John the Baptist, message. Trees must bear good fruit, or we cut them down. Saw it coming. Maybe, maybe not. I don't know if we saw this particular miracle, but we certainly can understand John's message. And it's getting serious now. And if that message from the desert, remember that man on the edge of the desert in the Jordan? If you didn't hear it then I'll put it right in the center of the city for you. If that didn't work for you 3 years ago, it's here today. The dead tree has a message. Isn't that something? So that's the drama. every tree must bear good fruit. The remarkable turn in the study is twofold. I'm coming down to point number five, bottom of five. First, Jesus could easily have said only the message of warning, right? He could have just said, see, trees must bear fruit, or we cut them down. Now, that would have echoed John the Baptist, right? But, instead, the words of the disciples, 22 through 24, are about faith and receiving gifts and prayer. Why would Jesus focus this miracle on faith and prayer, not just warning, bear fruit or else? Why does he turn and talk about faith? And if you ask, it's given.
Well, how are we really to bear good fruit?
There you go. There we go. See, wouldn't that be exactly the question the disciples would ask? Okay, I've got the warning, and I'm taking it seriously. How do I bear good fruit? Prayer and believing that your Heavenly Father gives what you ask. Oh, I can almost imagine some disciples saying, that's it. And then that kindly Jesus would put his hand on his shoulder and say, that's more than enough. If you could do that, ask in faith and believe his promises, okay, then bear fruit. And maybe the second one is, on the bottom of page five, the cursed tree. The cursed dead tree is the miracle. What good is a dead tree? But given the coming of Good Friday, why would a cursed dead tree early in the week be a fitting miracle? Why is this the last miracle? A dead tree. Good Friday. What good comes from a dead tree?
Nothing good comes from a dead Christ, but only a risen Christ.
Exactly. But he has died on the tree to pay for our sin. And from the tree rises again to raise us from the dead. But the dead tree of the cross is surely needed. I've never seen a stained glass window of the withered fig tree. Have you ever seen a stained glass window of the withered fig tree? They would be beyond me. I'm waiting. I'm going to whisper this. Don't spread it to them. I have my students in New Testament make a cross if they choose. They can write another five-page paper, which by the end of the semester they'd rather die than do that. So most of them choose this or another cross. Make a cross that is at the same time both beautiful and frightening. That's a picture of life and death, love and hate. I think the withered fig tree would make a great cross image. Have a central trunk and a dominant branch left and right, but let it be the withered fig tree. And from that dead tree comes not just the lesson, but from the dead tree comes life eternal. But don't tell them that, because I always tell them there are crosses I haven't yet seen. I've been doing this for 22 years, okay? And I've seen a lot of crosses in 22 years, but I've never seen that one. And I got one more that I won't share with you, just so I can really play close to the vest. And so if they say, oh, I bet you've seen every idea. Nope, not yet. Here's what we do. So, and they do a wonderful job. Oh, just wonderful. So the dead tree has a lesson for us. That's a good story. All right, let's go on to the next one. How are we doing? We're doing great. Half an hour. We got it. Wait, there's more. Okay, one more. You'll never forget this one. All right, now this one, I got a little more show and tell here to use. So here we go. Opening. We're on page 7. Excuse me. The old saying, if a little is good, more must be better. Right? We've all heard that. Sometimes this works and sometimes more is more and just too much. But when has a little been good and more is actually been a good thing? A little is good and you know what? They're right. More was better.
FaceTime with grandkids?
Oh. Exactly. Exactly. Until they're so distracted and so wound up, they're just like a little whirling dervish. By the way, she loves to hold the phone herself.
Oh.
So, grandma and grandpa are just like, whoa, I feel a little sick to my stomach for watching this. And no. But yeah, exactly. If I said, a little's good, more is better.
Ice cream.
Oh. Exactly. Right, exactly. And if he comes home with just a little half, you know, the lower half, what, did they stop making the pails, the 5-foot pails? Do they not make those anymore? Right, exactly. Yeah, exactly. But a little's good, more is better. Yeah.
My wife's pecan pie.
Oh. I missed that. Hi. Do you put ice cream on top of that?
No, I don't.
No, you don't?
She does, but I just enjoy the flavor.
Oh, my goodness.
It's not high. Oh, it's good stuff. Oh, it does. Yeah, really. More is better. You're looking good. And such. Many things, a little more is better. That's all right. Now, wait, swing the pendulum. On the other hand, when was a little just right and more was just too much?
Horseradish.
Okay, I didn't say I'm going to come in at all. Horseradish. All right. This is my wife's hand cream. All right, So before we go, almost always before we go someplace, we have to lube up the hands. Oh, not we, she. You know, How much do you need?
A dab.
Just a dab. Is that good? Is that better? No. This can't even open the door knob. Can you open this for me? We get to the point where you can't open the door knob. All right. Now I really like this stuff. This is the stuff I put on my motorcycle gloves. It's hand cream for leather. Okay, It's really sticky, gooey stuff. As you get, but it on a night like tonight when I'm riding home, if I don't put the overcovers on, it'll repel the water pretty well for the 30 miles I got to ride to go home. How much do you need? It's a gooey, sticky stuff. Not much. By the way, I did this last night anticipating. Boy, was I sticking this morning to the everything was just sticking. A little is good. Too much is too much. I grabbed just one bottle of fragrance. Moonlight Pass from Bath and Body Works. How much do you need? There's the little scripture thing.
Couple squirts.
There you go. Exactly. Oh, I should have walked through. Okay, whatever. You have that wonderful favorite on. What's her version of enough? There you go. You're all smiling. Boy, that was even the two pups were pretty potent up here. I don't know. You can even go to the back. Maybe not. Holly's going to smell me and say, "Where have you been?" Brian, write me a note saying he was with us. That's why he smells like he'd been someplace with someone. We don't want that. So we need just the right amount, right? That's what we're aiming for. Too much can be too much. Too little. Let's go. In this third study, we're going to meet a woman who definitely believed a little was good and more, much more, was better. She made a memorable evening for Jesus for all who read her account. But her story is in the middle of another of Mark's paired story. Before we get to her, we must go to the complete opposite setting with people whose hearts are as far from hers as can be. So let's read Mark 14. And all we need is the beginning of this one. It's really short. All we need is chapter 14, 1 and 2. Would somebody be so kind and read 1 and 2?
I will. It was now 2 days before the Passover and the Feast of Unleavened Bread. And the chief priests and the scribes were seeking how to arrest him by stealth and kill him. For they said, "Not during the feast, lest there be an uproar from the people."
Oh, how do you picture? I think I went here. We have to start in darkness. We know the plot's been coming since the desire to kill Jesus back in Mark 3:6. The plan has now come immediate. He's no longer in the distant region of Galilee. Now he's in Jerusalem. It's a time of Passover. That pressure, the plot has to accelerate. We cannot waste any more time. So how do you see their meeting in 1 and 2? Where is it? Door open, closed? How are their voices? How do they sound? How do you picture verses 1 and 2? And they took counsel together.
They're behind closed doors.
That door is open a little bit. There's no way that door is open. No. Is there a sign outside the door saying, "Meeting to assassinate, please come in"? Refreshments available? No. There's no ad. There's no outdoor. How do you see them inside? How are they with one another? Their voices, their faces.
Cowering and in secret.
I think there's a secrecy, and there's got to be some sense of fear. If we were brazen, we'd have the door open. We'd be doing this out toe-to-toe on the street. But we're not. We're behind the closed doors. Isn't that ironic, considering the closed doors that the disciples will be behind soon enough? The plot to kill him in its setting is going to be repeated after his death in the hiding of the disciples behind closed doors. So I think there is some of that. But besides the fear, how are they feeling about Jesus, what he's doing, and how it's going for them? Fear, but also
threatened.
Oh, threatened. Absolutely. If we were merely craven in fear, we might not have the backbone to say, kill him. We have got to kill him. Do you feel that tension? On the one hand, I agree 100%. I think there's a fearfulness. Close the door. Don't advertise this, for gosh sakes.
Well, and I think
what?
He's gotten a following, and so if they broadcast this, they might be the ones to be.
And that's what I say. Not during the feast, let there be a riot. Excuse me, keep Martin. Absolutely. So there's a fear of the people outside, and certainly a fear of his power. Excuse me. They must have been reporting to each other. Did you see how he came into the city? Did you see those people on Sunday? You know, we'll say Sunday, the first of the week. And it couldn't have been, yeah, that was quite a show. No, no, no. How would they have said, did you see how he came in the city?
Mm-hmm. And shaken by
it. And shaken, and yet also, we've got to do something. This is my tug-of-war principle. And I finally ran out of show and tell here. But if I throw a rope all the way across, and such, and you all laid onto it, and I started pulling. What are you going to do in return? You're going to pull back. Exactly. You don't even have to tell people, no, I want you to pull back when I pull. No, it never fails. You throw it out there to Dr. Garman and Tina, and you latch on, you'll pull back. It's inevitable. He comes in with this crowd, with this acclaim. There's not only some fear, but there's got to be also some, we've got to set things back. Who's in charge here? Well, we are. Well, we're supposed to be. We've got to pull back. And so in that darkness, they have their meeting. They fear an uproar of the people if the betrayal is done badly. How strange that this is their fear. They're afraid of the people. Think about that. Given what we know of Jesus and whose son he is, what might we tell them is their true fear? So just put yourself in at the end of verse 2. And you say to the leaders, if you could suddenly be in their midst and you had the courage to say, don't worry about the crowd. Friend, if you do this, I'll tell you who you need to fear. How would you end that sentence? If you do what you say you're going to do, the crowds are the least of your worries. I'll tell you who to fear. Who's to fear?
God himself.
You killed God's son. Crowds? You tell me that. Yeah, that's the least of your worries. Think about what you're going to do. And think about the fear that's going to come. By the way, Acts chapter 2. Remember the end of Peter's sermon on Pentecost? This Jesus, whom you crucified, God has made both Lord and Christ. And cut to the heart, they said, what should we do? And so this scenario is not altogether unthinkable. Peter does stand up to the whole of Jerusalem and say, let me tell you what you did. You killed the Son of God. And realizing that, they were scared to death, cut to the heart with that fear. So if we could step in early, of course we don't want to because we need this plot to go forward. But I just find that their misplaced fear is so interesting. They're afraid of the crowds. Oh, you've got bigger things to worry about. There you go. All right, so that's that. All right, now let's go on. The scene changes. So let's do the woman and verses 3 to 9. Would somebody give us 3 to 9?
And while he was at Bethany in the house of Simon the leper, as he was reclining at table, a woman came with an alabaster flask of ointment of pure nard, very costly, and she broke the flask and poured it over his head. There were some who said to themselves indignantly, why was the ointment wasted like that? For this ointment could have been sold for more than 300 denarii and given to the poor. And they scolded her. But Jesus said, leave her alone. Why do you trouble her? She has done a beautiful thing for me. For you always have the poor with you. And whenever you want, you can do good for them. But you will not always have me. She has done what she could. She has anointed my body beforehand for burial. And truly I say to you, wherever the gospel is proclaimed in the whole world, what she has done will be told in memory of her.
Isn't that marvelous? Well, the scene changes. We're at the bottom of page 7. We know nothing of the setting of the dinner other than it was a meal apparently open enough for the woman to come in on her own. Her perfume cost the equivalent of 300 days' work. This is a very compact treasure. You could hold a year in your hand. Isn't that a remarkable thing? The wages for a year is in that bottle. And she breaks it open. in opening the vial, she was all it was all going to be poured out, and so she breaks it open and she pours it out. Don't worry, I won't do that to Bath and Body Works, but can you imagine? Can you imagine what that would have been like? I mean, I don't know about you, but I'm still smelling the stuff that we went for, because you said twice, so I did it twice. But, yeah, there you go. I think I'm going to be carrying it over. I'm going to ride with the visor open the whole way, 30 miles, just to air this out. Da da da. Can you imagine? Also, in there must have been, and what a contrast to their meeting, the door to some degree opened. Because she's clearly not the center of the meal. She's not the center of the thing, and yet she was able to come in. Isn't that a wonderful contrast? I don't think you could have just wandered in onto the meeting in verses 1 and 2. Hey, how are you fellas doing? What's up today? Did I miss something? You know, no. But she could come, and she could come straight to him. Well, obviously the center of attention. And not only come to him, but do all of this. Isn't that an amazing contrast? They, in their closed door, in their fearfulness, no admittance. In this dinner, you come and bring your gift. Well, there, here we go. On top of page 8, what contrast do you imagine here as she pours out the perfume amidst the complaints of verses 4 and 5? Oh, yes. She's pouring this out, anointing him. And how do you hear there verses 4 and 5? How do you hear them in 4 and 5?
Oh, grumble, grumble, grumble.
Oh, yeah.
Don't let that money leave.
Exactly. You know, we could have sold this, da-da-da. And, of course, Judas maybe calculating his cut, so to speak, by carrying the bag and what it could have been sold for, and da-da-da, and such. And could have been sold for more than 300 denarii and such. And we'll take that as a likely amount. Was it inflated? Perhaps so, just for the argument, you know, as people have been known to do forever and ever. You could sell that on eBay for 300. Made in reality is 175. You know, we've all known how that works. All right. Jesus comes to her defense. They can always help the poor, though we must wonder if such hard-hearted people would actually ever care. I mean, think about what they're saying. You know, we could have sold that and given the money to the poor. Sure. Yeah.
After we take our cut.
Yeah, after our cut. Right, yeah. And I say, faithful in little, faithful in much. What did you do this today? What did you do last week? How much has gone out? Yeah, right. I don't know how else you could say. You know, da-da-da. That's one of those cases where a positive is actually a negative. Right? They say, we would sell this for the poor. Right. Sure, that's going to happen. So I think it's very unlikely. But the poor they can't see will remain. The Savior they have today will soon be gone. Do you realize what you have today? Do you see how near the end has come? Why is it striking that Jesus defends the woman for her gift, even while he reminds them of his own death? He points out the beautiful thing she's done in view of his own death. I think this is just the most interesting part in a way of this one. She's done this in view of my death. It's a beautiful thing she's done in preparing for my death. Do you hear the two sides?
Yeah.
She's done a beautiful thing. That's a beautiful thing. That's a wonderful thing. That's a beautiful, it's an upbuilding. Isn't that wonderful? It's in the context of what? What's going to happen to him? I'm going to die. Isn't that remarkable? Here's the image. I don't know if this works for you, but a wonderful woman, her name was Gertie, passed away in Butternut when I was there those years. She had 10 children, and 9 of them lived right in Butternut area, right around us, and one lived down here in Milwaukee. And when Gertie was passing away in the hospital, they were coming. Of course, the ones who lived around, that was no problem. Nobody was more than 10 miles away. And when their son made it up from Milwaukee, good kid, you know, but he just got the news and now he's got to drop everything and run up probably about a 5-hour drive from Milwaukee up to Butternut. When he came in to the hospital room, what was Gertie's attention? What did she say? She was still conscious. She knew the kids that were there. And she saw, his name is Michael. When she saw Michael come in. Michael, you're here. Did she ask about the trip? Yeah, no, she did. How was your trip? How was it? Oh, it's so good of you to come. Mm-hmm. That's the kind of woman she was. Mm-hmm. She talked about him. And what a wonderful thing it was that he drove up from Milwaukee to see her. Mm-hmm. Don't you want to put a hand on her shoulder and say, but Gertie, mm-hmm. you're dying. And she would have said, well, I know that. And she did. And he was there. It didn't take long. You know how they are. Do people hold on for something? You better believe it. They hold on. They hold on for Christmas, for the wedding, for graduation, for Michael to get up from Milwaukee, or whatever it is. But her beautiful thing was to focus on him. And she pointed out all the others, you know, so that the nine who were there all the time, oh, the girls, Kathy and Diane, I mean, they never left her. You know, they're just the best. Isn't that Jesus here? She has done a beautiful thing for me in view of my death. Isn't that a marvelous thing? He can look death right in the eye and it says it's coming. And maybe somebody needs to be reminded, it's coming. Don't kid yourself. But she has done a beautiful thing. You talk about the kindness of God, the kindness of Jesus. At this time, it could be all about me. But it wasn't. She has done a beautiful thing. So there it shimmers. Jesus says this will be remembered as long as the gospel is spoken. Yes, we read this gift still today. We might imagine that this gift of perfume endured for that week and maybe even onto Good Friday. What a contrast. The head that wears the bitter crown of thorns, so fragrant from the perfume. Wouldn't that have been something? I don't know. But could it be that that fragrance would endure more than one day, one evening? Right?
Just like that.
This stuff. It's still enduring on me, da da da, and you know, and it does. But can you imagine just pouring a year's worth of wages, perfume, must be stout stuff, and that doesn't linger on him? Doesn't that give that placing of the crown of thorns a new image and life? As the mean soldiers place it on his head, there's still the fragrance of her gift. Isn't that amazing?
Interesting thought.
It really is. She's done a beautiful thing. Well, now we've got to go back to the first story, though. That was the B, and there's one more. So would somebody read? It's really short. 10 and 11. Oh, we're doing great. We're perfect. 10 and 11.
Then Judas Iscariot, one of the 12, went to the chief priests to betray Jesus to them. They were delighted to hear this and promised to give him money. So he watched for an opportunity to hand him over.
What a contrast. Here I say, perhaps the gift of the perfume and the apparent waste of his fortune prompted the jealousy and greed of Judas.
Yeah.
Can you imagine that? 300 denarii, whole year's wages, just slipped through his fingers.
It's almost like, that does it.
Exactly. I'm going, before we waste any more. You got to get this while it's there or something. We don't know. And of course we know that Satan entered into Judas and prompted him towards this. So there's also that. But surely Judas's greed is coming out here in this one. What a contrast! The woman does a beautiful thing, pouring out a year's worth of wages, all in view of his death. Judas snatches up the money and says, "Mine." Could you draw a sharper opposites between the two of them? And so the money, losing the opportunity for the 300 denarii, he snatches for the silver, the money he had, but still had to look for the opportune time. What an exchange. In his hand, Judas has the silver, but must deliver Jesus in order to keep the small fortune. He cannot keep both, the silver and the Savior, one or the other. What would we say to Judas as he seeks to finish this exchange? And what would the generous woman say to him? What would you say to Judas, who on the one hand has a slim hold on the Savior, and the other hand, a firm grasp on his silver? What would you say? Oh, Judas.
What do you think you're doing?
What do you think you're doing? I want the money. Right?
But did he have a choice?
That's a wonderful question. Prompted by Satan, necessary that one would do this, but woe to the one who does it. That's a deep water, isn't it? You know, it alternates truly. And depending on when you have the John text where Satan enters, it seems that he's driven forward. Here, we have a suggestion that it's the pure greed. It's just simply, I want the money. I want the money. But it's a both and, I'm not wise enough to distinguish them.
But after the death of before the death of Jesus, he had a chance to have forgiveness.
Exactly.
God, Jesus provided that. But
right. Who is the one who betrays? The one whose hand is on the table with me. You know, and prompts him with that. I'll even push you to the end. When he meets Jesus in the garden, and he comes with the soldiers, and he says to him, friend, do what you come for. But wouldn't that have been a point for him on hearing that simple word, friend? Do what you come for. Let Judas say, I can't. I can't. Protect me. But he can't, because it has to happen to me. It has to go forward. But what would the woman say to Judas? Can I make it in a simple, Judas in his greediness, snatching up the silver. If she could meet him, wouldn't this be amazing? It's another closed door meeting, of course. And Judas comes bursting out with his bag of silver. She, knowing everything, meets him right at the door. What would she say to him? He's got his bag of silver, 30 pieces. I'd have her ask a question. Is that all? Is that all? Your soul's your soul. That's all. You sold the Son of God. That's all. That's all you got. I poured out a year. Counted all good. That'd be my question for her. Mm-hmm. Just ask him that. Is that all? I think he'd still push her aside and dash away. You know, driven on because it has to happen. Satan is pushing him in that direction. But there he is. What a contrast. These two. By the way, remember we mentioned that sometimes, wait, there's more. It's the opposite. It's the tape and the caulk. I don't know how you can push these two further apart. These are really different, aren't they? The only thing that ties them together is money. You know, let's hire somebody. We found him. Cheap price, 30 pieces of silver. In the middle, the woman pouring out a year's worth of life and such. But otherwise, aren't they the complete opposites? The fearful hiding, the presumed power, the desperate greediness, the perhaps flattery. Oh, Judas, you're the one we want. Oh, Judas, you're the one we're looking for. And in the middle, how would you describe the woman? How is she framed? But, oh, so different from the framing of the plot and the greedy man.
Open
how is
she?
Go, open and honest. Keep on going.
Loving.
Loving. Absolutely.
He's not afraid to shoulder love.
Not afraid. Bold. Open door. I'm walking in. And I don't care what they say. I don't care what they say. Right. Yeah.
No. There's no limit to the honor and love we can bestow on Jesus.
Exactly. If this is a beautiful thing, and how gracious of him to say, what she's done is a beautiful thing. But what of that? Wouldn't she say, but what of that? What did I do compared to what he's going to do? I gave him perfume. Lasts a few days. He gives us eternal life that'll never end. Wow. And he was gracious enough to call me one who did a beautiful thing. Wouldn't she be the first one to say, who am I? And what was that compared to what he did? Nothing. But he's right. She's done a beautiful thing, and wherever the gospel is proclaimed, we should talk about what she did. She did a beautiful thing. In the context of the frightened plotters and the greedy grasping of Judas, she did a beautiful thing. What a beautiful thing. Darkness and darkness, the light shines in the middle. This is about as opposite as you can get. So I don't really have a there's more example that really matches that one. Da da da. And so there we are. This episode is too much and too little. The perfume poured out so extravagantly seemed too much, but really just enough. The small fortune Judas grasped was far too little for the trade that he made. And there at the other hand, oh, we'll just go to the very ending of page 9. On the other hand, we can go to the dinner of the generous woman and stand in awe with her faith and generosity, which saw Jesus not as a lost cause, but as the Savior giving his life as a pleasing sacrifice for us all. There we go. Well, We're a few minutes early, but we'll call her done, and you'll be in your car by 5:30. When am I coming home? There we go. So don't dawdle. Dr. Gehrman, did you need anything last words for the crew?
Just thanks for your presentation.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you.